This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Fifth Circuit, Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. This is Texas. Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution guides me to this document dated May 2022. Congress has given the Securities and Exchange Commission substantial power to enforce the nation's security laws. It often acts as both prosecutor and judge, and its decisions have broad consequences for personal liberty and property. But the Constitution constrains the SEC's powers by protecting individual rights and the prerogatives of other branches of government. This case is about the nature and extent of those constraints in securities fraud cases in which the SEC seeks penalties. The case is Jarchezi. I welcome Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He is a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, and he is my guide through what Richard explains to me is constitutional history and an absence of clarity about the SEC's powers since the New Deal. Richard, a very good evening to you. This case recently handed down, 2-1 decision in the Fifth Circuit, speaks to questions that you raise in your essay that have not been answered, at least since the late 19th century, about the powers of the administrative state. Is there an explanation for why these powers have not been answered? Because you're asking very bold questions. Good evening to you.
Yes, well, what happens is American history tends to go through cycles. And when the New Deal administrative state was created in the 1930s, there was at the time a real set of dust-ups and flares, and it turned out that the New Deal is in the courts when every single one of these decisions, including a case called Humphrey's Executor, which said, in effect, that you could create independent administrative agencies that the president himself could not fire its members. Okay. And the settlement, all the way through a very long period of time, said, we like the administrative state. What we're going to do is to figure out how we fine-tune it. Starting later on in the early Reagan years, and then again in the early Obama years, a different sensibility started to take place by many people, and I would count myself as one of them, who said, you just can't look at this status quo and be perfectly happy with the way in which things are. You have to reexamine it to some extent by first principles. So if you look at this particular case, Judge Elrod and Judge Oldham are young. Judge Davis, who dissented, is 88 years or 86 years old, is obviously a huge generational differences. And what you do is you see that the attack can take place on one of two fronts. One of the fronts has to do with individual rights, and the natural home for that is the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which says, nor shall life, liberty, or property be deprived without due process of law, which has generally been said to have a hearing and a right to talk before a neutral judge. Okay, so that's one line. But then we have all these structural provisions in the Constitution. And if you go back to what Hamilton said a very long time ago, he said, look, a Bill of Rights is really about the structure of government. We constrain it. It turns out it's a role, but it's not necessarily the whole thing. And so what happens is, what she does is she says, I'm going to look at the structural part of this case, and I'm going to ignore the due process part of the case. And the structural part of the case has to do with the separation of powers, the right to have a trial by jury. It has to do with the ability of the executive to delegate to administrative officials with respect to the Take Care Clause, and it has to do with the independence of administrative agencies. And she takes that stuff up, and she basically throws a haymaker, saying that everything that has been done in the past 90 years runs afoul of these kinds of constraints. My view is she's right about the fact that there's something deeply problematic about this stuff, but I tend to think of it more as a universal guarantee of due process, which cannot be satisfied if what you do is you put these trial courts into the administrative agency so that they're both prosecuted, having defined the regulations, and then they administer it. So I think the minimum condition, and something that should be reversed from the old consensus, is that there can be no independent agency which has adjudicative power. That has to be put into some kind of an independent court. There are Article I courts which are created in specialized areas. There's the general Article III courts. Article 1 courts are not in the Constitution but have been evolved over history. Article 3 courts are, but you'd have to do it in that particular raid. And so in the essay I wrote on Hoover, I tried to explain the limitations of the three particular arguments that Judge Elrod put forward on behalf of the structuralist account.
The three arguments are, one, the question of at common law. The SEC did not exist in 1789 when the Constitution was fashioned. It's a creation of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act. And the first administrator, I believe, was a man who was notorious even then for violating what you would say is common practice on Wall Street. That would be Joseph Kennedy. Two, Congress is to guide the SEC whether you sue it, whether you are suing somebody for damages or whether they have the right to a court trial for their abuse, alleged abuse. And three is the take care clause. And that there is the question of the administrative state ignoring due process. Richard, all three are substantial. However, I can imagine since 1934, this has come up before. Is it in the power of the SEC or Congress to address these questions and clean up these what you'd have to say, missing pieces?
Well, the answer is to a certain degree it can. It can certainly clarify kinds of things so as to get rid of charges of vagueness. But if it were to decree that we are putting this in an administrative agency and we really think it's an action at common law, but we're going to deny you the jury, there'd be a huge battle over that question. As I've indicated, if you look at the past authorities, they tend to be evenly split. And there's one group that says if it turns out that you have a jury trial in a court, if they want to shift it to a different form, they can't use it strategically to deny you the rights. And then there are other people who said, no, this is the world of Woodrow Wilson, of administrative expertise. We switch because we have a completely different conception of government, and that conception of government is one of government by experts in which juries have no place whatsoever, and so we can do it. And one of the first cases that sort of said we don't worry about the Seventh Amendment was a little tag end in the case having to do with the creation of the National Labor Relations Act, because people wanted to say, hey, if you're going to start to fine these companies for unfair labor practices, isn't that something which is an action at common law? The same thing got originally in connection with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, where they provided for trials by judges, not juries. And somebody says, wait, these are actions at common law, aren't they? And the answer is not when you're in the South, where you're going to have juries that are going to nullify everything that we want to do. And then when the nullification threat passed, all of a sudden jury trials were put back into the statute. So this is a very long history. And it turns out it's a very difficult problem. And my general view is, if it is the kind of thing that is a common law action, you have to have a jury inside the administrative agency, assuming you're allowed to try inside an administrative agency. But you don't need it for those things which are not actions at common law. And if you look at what they're demanding, all the efforts to block people from engaging in securities transactions and working on the exchanges and taking jobs in the industry, those are equitable powers. And back in 1789, if it was an equitable power, it went to the Court of Chancery, a totally different system, and jury trials were not allowed. And now what happens is we have a case which brings both, and therefore what you do is you have a constitutional conundrum rather than a clear constitutional solution.
We have here a penalty that the court is saying is vacated, I believe that's the technical word. The serious sanctions against Jarchese include a civil penalty of $300,000, disgorgement of $685,000 in what is characterized as ill-gotten gains, and a set of prohibitions about engaging in industry activities going forward. In other words, delimiting the ability of Jarchese to engage in his or her chosen occupation. Now, Richard, all of those are penalties. Again, I'm not a law student. It's just that common sense would issue that those penalties are severe for an individual. However, I puzzle also $300,000 on Wall Street, Richard. That's money for chumps. Richard, this is not, these are not big numbers given what we see routinely are...
But what happens routinely, you see them suing Chase National Bank for $2 billion. But if this is an individual advisor or a broker and whose income is probably, say, in the mid six figures, it's a lot of money. And the prohibitions are much more savage than the other thing. The Loria case, which I referred to in this thing, was another SEC prosecution. It was held by the Supreme Court to be improperly conceived because they didn't appoint the internal judge in the right way. They go back and fix that. They still come after him. And in the end, when I spoke to his lawyer, she said, look, he had to pay out very disadvantageously. He was morally wasted on the one hand and financially broke on the other. The SEC doesn't worry about financial constraints when it sues, but when they're hitting individual advisors, of which there are many on Wall Street, what they're doing in a strange way is making the world a little bit safer for the really big companies, the Fidelities and the Merrill Lynches and so forth, because they have the wherewithal and the abilities to either use influence or might to resist what's going on. So what happens is this is an attack on the small entrepreneur, and it is really devastating. People don't come back from these kinds of sanctions. You're depriving people of their livelihood. So let's just put it to this way. If the only thing they said is, we're going to waive the $1 million in fines. You can't practice your profession for the rest of your life. You would never get a jury at common law because it's an equitable proceeding. So what you don't understand, and you're not alone about this, is that at the time that the jury trial was protected, there was a radical division between cases in law and cases in equity. And in cases in equities, it was basically the prerogative of the count that ran. And there was a lot of hostility to equitable courts in the revolutionary fervor. And somebody said, hey, we don't need courts of equity. Then what happens is you realize you can't issue injunctions in nuisance cases. You can't foreclose mortgages. You can't order specific performance, that is, making people buy or sell real estate when these transactions are done. So if you look at Article 3, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity. What they did is they preserved the English distinction. And then when it came to the Seventh Amendment, it only applied to actions at common law, not to actions in the court of equity. And then when you have both of them, that's when you get the problem. So I think the correct way to do this is it's just sleazy for you to tell somebody, we're going to try you in our own court, and anything we do is going to be done under our own rules. And remember, the rules on how you present witnesses, gather evidence, and all the rest of that stuff are also going to be created by the FTC. And my friend Jonathan Mitchell in the Loria case wrote a devastating brief against the practice off of the New Civil Liberties Alliance with Philip Hamburger and Mark Chenoweth. And it went on deaf ears because the Supreme Court decided to play a game of minimalism and to avoid this issue. And one of the things that happens is there's a long constitutional tradition of avoidance. Don't take on the big issues if you could deal with the little issues. I'm not a real fan of that position because it means that people are going to be kept into limbo for another several years until somebody actually comes back and wants to do this. And I was kind of disappointed in the decision by Eldred and Oldham to do only the structural stuff because I think the due process claims are much more impervious and they make it very clear that one thing that has to be done right now and does not disrupt anything in terms of administrative continuity is to say, if you want to try somebody, it has to be a trial to an independent body. And it's not enough to say, we could try you in our own courts, keep you and hound you for 5 years, and then, if you're lucky, you could go to a court of appeals, and 2 years later, maybe get something. The point about protection is it's not only about ultimate vindication at the end of the day. It has to be about the way in which the process continues from day one until you get to the appeals court. And the decisions that are made by the SEC in cases like this are simple outrages, picked up, as you noted, against little people for whom $1 million is a lot of money.
Richard Epstein, professor at NYU and the University of Chicago in law. He's a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.